Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by Senior Meditation Instructor Kathy Lamo Jackson, is entitled The Mahamudra Lineage Prayer, A Guide to Practice, Talk 3. All beginning students in our lineage are taught shamatha meditation, also known as shine or calm abiding meditation. In this chapter, we examine shamatha as it is taught in mahamudra practice and learn how it differs from ordinary shamatha. Kathy Lamo gives a detailed review of basic shamatha meditation techniques, which are common to both types, while emphasizing the value of practicing ordinary shamatha for our well-being in general, as well as in preparation for eventually beginning the path of mahamudra. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everyone. Today we're going to be continuing with the book. In Chapter 3, the book is called The Mahamudra Lineage Prayer, A Guide to Practice by Kenjin Trangu. It's actually Venerable Kenjin Trangu Rinpoche, but they call it his name here is just Kenjin Trangu. And have any of you been to the other talks, probably by Eric?
Yeah.
Can you show me your hands? Okay, so I can quiz you today. My next question is, does anyone have this book? Oh, you guys have got to get it. It's really cheap on Amazon right now, like $13 or something. I mean, you know how I tend to mark my books. This book is amazing. Anyway, before I get chattering, let's start with, we're going to use the red prayer book. And the very first, well, actually page 3, which is the first prayer. And this is the prayer that's from the book. This is called the Mahamudra Lineage Prayer. It's also called Dorji Tong Tungma, which means the short Vajradhara. So we'll start. We're just going to do it in English. And I'm going to pause at certain points because this is broken up into 5 segments. So let's begin. Great Vajradhara, Talopa, Naropa, Marpa, Milarepa, Lord of Dharma, Gampopa, Knower of the 3 Times, Omniscient Karmapa, Lineage holders of the 4 great and 8 lesser schools, Drikung, Taklung, Sapa, Glorious Drukpa, and others, you have mastered the profound path of Mahamudra. The Dakpo Kagyu, unrivaled protectors of sentient beings, I pray to you, Kagyu Lamas, grant your blessings that I may follow your tradition and example. So that was the very first section, which is praying to this lineage of this prayer. But I'll go into that in a few minutes. Next, as is taught, detachment is the foot of meditation. Attachment to food and wealth disappears to the meditator who gives up the ties to this life. Grant your blessings that attachment to ownership and honor cease. As is taught, devotion is the head of meditation. The Lama opens the door to the profound oral teachings. To the meditator who also turns to him, grant your blessing that uncontrived devotion be born within. As is taught, unwavering attention is the body of meditation. Whatever arises is the fresh nature of thought. To the meditator who rests there in naturalness, grant your blessing that meditation be free from intellectualization. As is taught, the essence of thoughts is Dharmakaya. They are nothing whatsoever, and yet they arise. To the meditator who reflects upon the unobstructed play of the mind, grant your blessing that the inseparability of samsara and nirvana be realized. Through all my births, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama, and so enjoy the glory of the Dharma. May I completely accomplish the qualities of the path and stages, and quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. So, this prayer has been around since the 1400s. It's been around for a while. It is said, any Kagyu monastery or center I've ever been to, we always do this before any other practice. Venerable Trungpa Rinpoche. How many of you know who Trungpa Rinpoche is? Trungpa Rinpoche was very close to Kempo Karcha Rinpoche. He's our teacher that just passed. They came from the same monastery, the Trungpa Monastery in eastern Tibet. And his last lifetime, he did not teach very much. But his aspiration was to teach. In this lifetime, he is one of the most brilliant scholars. He's the kind of teacher, whatever he says, it sticks somewhere deep inside and you catch it. He's the tutor of the Karmapa. He was, and he's just a brilliant teacher, but he has such compassion. So he's that wonderful mixture of wisdom and compassion. So he is the one that so kindly put this book together. So I should actually say Clark Johnson put the book together. He's the editor. But Trungpa Rinpoche taught on this prayer in so many different places. At home, I have a little booklet from the 70s, I remember, and I didn't understand any of it. So it was so nice that this book was put together based on many, many different teachings compiled. Lama Yeshe Gyamso was one of the translators. We know who he is. Many famous translators helped translate this. So sometimes if you see certain terms, you know it's Yeshe. He talks about blessings in a different, special way. So I just thought for a few minutes, maybe at least 10, I want to go through what we've covered so far in case you haven't been here. Have you all been studying this so I don't need to do that? No, I'm joking. I never do. So let me go through. So this book has 5 chapters, and in the back, some just amazing instructions. There's like 7 appendix notes and glossaries. Trungpa Rinpoche is the teacher whose books I go to for glossaries. Like if I want to know a definition, just as a hint for all of you, you're trying to study something, I always go in my shrine room, go into my bookcase, and pull out Trungpa Rinpoche's books because I know he's going to give the definitive answer. And a lot of his students are Western. He has a lot of monasteries, of course, in Tibet, in Nepal, and India. But if you ever have a chance, you should check him out. Kempo Karcha Rinpoche's brother is still alive, I believe, and he lived at his monastery his whole life in Nepal. But the more interesting story is Kempo Karcha Rinpoche was his key keeper. So I believe stories that Kempo Rinpoche kind of taught him, because he's a little older than, he was about 10 years older. They're very, very close. So I feel sometimes a little bit of Rinpoche when I read about Trungpa Rinpoche. So he's the one, based on many of the teachings that this is from. And so His Holiness did the foreword of this book. And he said that this prayer combines practice of Mahamudra and the stages of that path. And it provides a concise guide to this practice. And so this is more than just a prayer asking for something. This is a prayer to inspire us to do the practice. It inspires us who did it before us and what steps we're going to take. And I had a nice talk with Lama Kathy last night, and I said, this book opens a lot of doors. Don't you think we should have more teachings on this from you? Lama Kathy is a wonderful teacher of Mahamudra, and I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. So make that aspiration prayer if you would like that, because I think it would be lovely if she would give us a much deeper insight into all of this. All right. So going back to this, His Holiness in the foreword said that this prayer is beautiful because it really expresses the main points of what you need to know about Mahamudra. And it uses very simple language and everyday imagery that, if you think about it, this is written, over 500 years ago, and we still understand it. That's kind of interesting. Well, not 500 years ago, 1400s. So let's talk for a minute. I'm sure Eric did a beautiful job, but I'm just going to do a quick review on the author. He has 2 names. His shorter name is Pengar Zhangpo. He was a student of the 6th Karmapa and tutor of the 7th. And there's a special place in northern Tibet where the people would go to do long retreats. Now, he did an 18-year retreat. And so they go to this island. And so in the summer, it's a beautiful place to do retreat. There's a little mountain there and a cave inside. Great place to go and do your retreat. And sorry, the summer is the hardest time. The winter is easy because there's ice, you know. So there's the island in the middle, then the river ices up, and you can just walk right into it. But the summer was the hardest time. There's great stories of a lot of yogis are stuck there in the summer, and they can't get back to the shore to get their food and other things. But for some reason, Pengur Zangpo had no obstacles with that. It's very unusual. He was there for 18 years. And what was he doing for 18 years? He was doing the Mahamudra practice of resting in the nature of his mind. And when he left there, this prayer came, just flowed out of him, and he wrote it down. So this is from him, basically his gift from his experience. So what's really unique and very beautiful about Vajrayana Buddhism is how many transmissions we're receiving all the time. And so this is basically a transmission of Mahamudra from him. So, and then after that, he went on and became the tutor, like I said, of the seventh Karmapa. So the first chapter goes over the lineage. And Eric went over that already. And the second chapter goes over a lot of the preliminaries, which we'll talk about in a second. The third chapter is shamatha, not exactly shamatha we do here on Sunday, kind of the next step of shamatha. And the fourth chapter is vipassana, or resting in your Buddha nature, which is like the next step of shamatha. And then the last one is your conduct after you start reaching these levels of different levels of awareness. And so it's a really nice little package, right? Who to be inspired by, how to get ready for it, and then to start. So I have to watch the time. What about this? All right. So one very interesting thing that His Holiness said that, and in this book it's emphasized, anyone can learn this. In ancient times, it was very hard to learn Mahamudra. You had to be monastic. You had to go through many, many years of certain training. But a new stream of teachers came along, including Gampopa and the Lamrim tradition, where they did certain preliminaries. And then when he met his teacher, Milarepa, he then learned another style of Mahamudra. So we'll keep moving through that. So I thought I'm going to read a few things from here. So this is, so first maybe I should talk about the lineage. I keep thinking everyone knows about this. So, Don, maybe you can help me. What book was it where we covered a lot of the Karmapas? It was a book about the Karmapas, right? I can't remember. There's so many. Yeah. I can see it in my head, but. So the past so many months ago, we went through all of our lineage holders, and that included the short lineage. So is there a poster in back of me? No. Okay. So in most monasteries, there's a huge poster or tanka, which we did have before the fire, of our lineage. So at the very top, so have any of you, anyone here not seen a lineage tree? No. Okay, so it's basically this beautiful canvas painting, and it has all these different people on it, and it's in a very orderly fashion. And the very center of it is called the short lineage, the direct lineage. It has Vajradhara, Marpa, Milarepa, Gampopa, and Dusum Kempa. So, and that's the beginning of the prayer, right? Dorje Chang, Chen, Tilopa, Naropa, you're saying all of their names when you're saying that. So do you all see that in the Mahamudra prayer there? The very first line, it says Dorje Chang. This is in Tibetan. Dorje Chang, Chen, so it means great. And then Talo, that's Talopa. Naro is Naropa. Then there's Marpa. And then Milarepa is Mila. And Chuje Gampopa. So we're just ticking off all the lineage. But it's the short lineage. It's not all the Karmapas, which of course are part of our lineage, but this is the Mahamudra lineage that we're going to be talking about today. So that was what's in this prayer that we say all the time. It also mentions the four great in the eight lesser schools of Karma Kagyu. And why are we picking these teachers? Why were they used? Because these were masters of Mahamudra. This was their main practice, was the Mahamudra practice. So maybe for just one second, we should talk about Mahamudra. I know many people in this room. I know you. You've had teachings from Mindy Rinpoche, Kempa Rinpoche, and Trungpa Rinpoche in the Karmapa on Mahamudra. Mahamudra is, it's so simple, it's hard, because it's our natural state, but we're so good at being busy with our thoughts. And this is why we do meditation. Our mind is always flowing, of course, there's a continuum going, but it has to do with our attachment to everything and wanting certain things and being attracted to certain things when we meditate, so that it kind of gets in the way of this natural clarity, this natural lucidity that's there all the time. But they say every day in your life, you will have moments of clarity. Have any of you had that? Like just, it might be a flash. It might be an hour if you're really lucky. 2 minutes, I'd be thrilled. But just like that moment of, it's beyond words. Truly a beyond word, and we're not really supposed to ever really describe Mahamudra because everyone experiences it a little differently. So this is kind of our goal as Tibetan Buddhists in our lineage, is to attain that state of awakening. That's our goal. And it's not something where we have to shave our heads, which might be good for my haircut right now, where we don't have to shave our heads. We don't have to give everything up. You can still live the life of a householder if you want, like Marpa. This is why he was such an inspiration. Then one of his students was Milarepa, who was a real ascetic yogi. And it's true, his skin turned blue-green from eating so many nettles, because that's all he ate. I mean, but he was a famous meditator. He sacrificed so much. He had a really sketchy mother and sketchy childhood of kind of going the dark side and killing a lot of people. So that's what I love about him. He's a great example. Anyone can follow this path. Anyone. And he followed it with such diligence because he had a wonderful teacher in Marpa. Marpa was tough but wonderful. And then later, he had students. So this is a lineage where they have students. So now the lineage keeps going. And his students were Rurachungpa and Gampopa. Gampopa had been a doctor and later become monastic. And he was brilliant. He had one of those brilliant minds. And then later on, this went on. And the first Karmapa, Dusum Kempa, was then a student of Gampopa. So this lineage kept trickling. Now it's coming through all of us. So it's an alive lineage, which is so amazing about it. So that's sort of part of it. So what do we do? Well, there's practices we're going to learn. But first, you need to be prepared. So at our center, and at all KTCs, in a KTD monastery, we do a type of shamatha. And you've all probably learned it up in the class, where you sit with the 7 points of Virochana, you position your body a certain way, and we follow the breath, right? Or you follow counting. Well, Mahamudra goes beyond that. Mahamudra is later on, you drop all of that. And so this is why I called Lama Kathy last night. I said, what happens when I mention this? She said, tell them all not to do that. She said, I tried and got in a lot of trouble with my teachers. So sometimes it will naturally stop, you know. But this is why I'm hoping Lama Kathy soon can teach a class, because there's some wonderful trainings on what to do with the mind, following the senses, following so many different things. So at this center, so a lot of people use the word shamatha, and it's even a Hindu word. So shamatha is Sanskrit. Shine is the Tibetan, and it means tranquility. But we have two types of shine. We have the shine we do here every Sunday with a form. Either we meditate looking at a statue. Some people, some exercises, you actually see a statue or a picture of your teacher, or a flower, or just a view, a beautiful sky. And then there's the internal type of focus we have, and that would be counting, or internally following the breath. And that's fine. Just keep doing that. This is just kind of an FYI. Later on, that will change with your instructions. And then also, the next class will be on Vipassana. And it's very different from Theravada and Vipassana. I just want to make sure people know the words sound alike, but they are very different. It's a different lineage, and it's not Mahamudra Vipassana. All right. So moving on to the preliminaries, preliminaries are all about attachment. And as long as we are possessed by cravings and have unsatisfied attachments for things in this life, we're unable to rest our mind in meditation. So many of you have heard of Ngunjo, and some of the tools that this is in chapter 2, some wonderful tools and techniques we use are the four ordinaries and the four extraordinaries. And so I'll see if the book has the four ordinaries. I think they word it very nicely in here. So some people call it the four common preliminary practices. Often they're called the four thoughts that turn the mind to practicing Dharma. The first one is, and this is not something where you just read it and that this is it for the day. A lot of people in retreats will do a month on each of these four. So the first is contemplating the preciousness of your birth. I want to see if this isn't one of those really cool little, what are these called? Appendixes. Hold on. I think it is. Okay, so our human birth, all of you in this room have a very fortunate birth. And most of us don't really think about it, but of course, somewhere in the past, it was heavily looked. This is from the Lam Rim tradition, Gampopa. So to be born here, we've not been born into one of the hell realms or as a hungry ghost or as an animal or in the god realm, which is very samsaric. Or we've not been born in a country that does not have Buddhism. And we do not possess wrong views that there's no such thing as karma or to follow virtue. Not to be born with a Buddha has not appeared. So we are very lucky. We've not seen the Buddha, but he's in our history, even though it was 500 years before the current era. And then not being either too mentally or too physically handicapped in order to be able to understand the Dharma. And what we're endowed with, we're born as human. We're born in a land where there is freedom to practice Buddhism. Not everywhere in this planet can we practice Buddha Dharma. One other endowment is to have all of one's mental and physical facilities needed to practice. Not to experience great negative karma that includes not practicing. We're able to have faith. To be born in a world where the Buddha has appeared. That's in the other one. And have this Buddha teach the Dharma. Not all Buddhas that appear teach. To be born at a time where Buddhism still exists. To be born in a place where Dharma is practiced. Here, it's how amazing. And have spiritual masters that will guide us and accept us as students. Some of the older texts talk about not being born in the land of barbarians. We have a very fortunate life here. I've talked about this many times, but we have so many. I lived in India for a year, so I can tell you we have warm water here. We have clean food. You don't even have to think about it, except for romaine lettuce right now. But, you know, we have a lot of things to be able to practice the Dharma. So this is something that we really do like to contemplate on. Then the next one is impermanence, which I think the biggest lesson of impermanence is it's all changing. Don't take it for granted. It's not static. Next is a lot of our life is influenced by our karma, good and bad. And to try and live more of a virtuous life. And the last reminder, which is very important, is called the unsatisfactoriness of our existence. So sometimes we think this is just amazing. You know, when things are going really well, when we just, oh, things couldn't get any better than this, you know, and then everything doesn't go well. And then, which is wonderful about our existence in a world of, you know, positive and negative, where we have both sides of everything. So this is all impermanent. When we leave here, have we used this life well? So that's kind of the point of these. And they're not to make you kind of be really down about it. It's like, wow, we have a lot. So this is getting us ready to do, to move on. So this is a preliminary. The next preliminary is Ngundro. Or I think some of you are doing Ngundro, right? Anyone doing Ngundro? Well, I guess I see a room of people going to do Ngundro now. So, and I read something I never read before. Trungpa Rinpoche said, you do not have to do or finish Ngundro to practice Maha Mudra. When he asked His Holiness Gyawa Karmapa the 16th, when he first came, before he was coming to the West, he said, what shall I teach him? He said, Maha Mudra. He said that to so many Westerners, so many people. Our minds are ready for that Maha Mudra stuff. So I will say, Ngundro is very purifying. For some of that you might not know, it's where you do, it's usually done over a few years or a century, it just depends on who you are, where you do 111,000 prostrations while you're visualizing the lineage, the Maha Mudra lineage tree. This is called Maha Mudra practice. And this is practice is called a preliminary. People think Ngundro is the end. It's just a preliminary practice. Again, it's just one of these famous preliminaries. But it's taking refuge in that lineage, in everything that's in this prayer, and then also engendering and developing compassion and bodhicitta. So we do that 111,000 times. And some people start young, you know, wear knee pads. But it's I remember after my stroke, I was most upset because I told Rinpoche I was only halfway done with prostrations. And he said, now you're going to have to do the rest sitting, you know, visualizing it. So hard. I'm really a physical person. To sit there and just visualize it. Because you actually stand and you go all the way down the ground and you come back. So it's very purifying for the body and the speech because you're saying a mantra and the mind. It's just a very amazing practice to do. And often for new people, you'll see when a teacher comes here that we will prostrate to them. And it's not to that person, that personality. It's what they've invested. In my opinion, it's their devotion to the Holy Dharma. And they're so inspiring and out of respect. So I talked about preliminaries, the ordinary, which was the birth, impermanence, karma, and unsatisfactoriness, or samsara, the condition where we live. Because we're all kind of tricked into believing this is all amazing. And I mean, with Amazon, how it just can't get much better than that. But you really got to watch it. So, and then the extraordinary is the Ngundro, where we take refuge. Then the second step is we actually do a practice called Vajrasattva, where we visualize all of our defilements, all that stuff that's deep inside there from since beginningless time is cleaned out and purified. And it's a very, very, very special practice. Next, and it's very quiet, like prostration is just kind of, I'm very awkward, so it's really loud and clunky. Then the Vajrasattva is very quiet. Then the next practice I love is really loud because you're offering to the universe and to all beings all your wealth, all anything you have that you could offer, real or imagined. And this is where you toss rice in the air, and it's just a really beautiful thing. And you do 111,000 of these, of the mantras. Then the last one is the fourth one, which is really special. It's called Guru Yoga, where you visualize this lineage and then all the karma buzz, and you visualize that you receive all their blessings and they enter into you and you become invested in that. You are part of that lineage. And it's very powerful. So when Kempo Rinpoche died, we told everyone, and you can do this now also if you want the instruction. If you can't get hold of Lama Kathy, I can give it to you. Of because it's right in the Ngundro text of visualizing your gurus in front of you. And since Rinpoche had just passed, he was in a very special state of awareness and of Dharma. He was in the Dharmakaya. And so we were visualizing receiving his blessings through our body, our speech, and our mind. And so that's that. So that so far, those were the two or sort of three main chapters. Now the third one, I have a little time. The third one is the beginning of the main practice, part one, which is shamatha or mahamudra shamatha. Shamatha is translated as tranquility, just to let you know. Okay, let me look up something here. Okay. And as I said earlier, there's different types of shamatha, mostly just two types. One where we have a focus and one where we don't, we just let go. Okay. So, Trungpa Rinpoche says, in the last chapter, I discussed the common and uncommon preliminaries. Now I will discuss the main practice, which has two parts. And this is the verse. Non-distraction is the body of meditation. Whatever arises is fresh, the nature of thought. To the meditator who rests simply in naturalness, I can't say this word, it's my stroke. Naturalness, I said it. Grant your blessings so that my meditation is free from conceptualization. So, and he goes on to say, normally when we think about shamatha or meditation, we think of a practice, a state that we can attain. But when we are actually practicing and looking at our thoughts, we don't see any particular thing. Nevertheless, at this time of looking, there is an unimpaired and unceasing clarity that is a fundamental characteristic of our mind. So I'm going to say that again. But when we are actually practicing and looking at our thoughts, we don't see any particular thing. Nevertheless, at this time of looking, there is an unimpaired, unceasing clarity that is a fundamental characteristic of our mind, this type of clarity. While we don't experience any particular object of our meditation, and there's no particular object that we are meditating on, this basic luminous clarity is still there. And that is the whole point of Mahamudra, is to rest in that naturalness. We don't force it. This is a practice of letting go, not forcing. I touched on this earlier, but I'll touch on it again about the shamatha we do here in the Mahamudra shamatha. In the shamatha that one ordinarily practices, one usually uses a support for the observation of the mind. There's something that is taken to the mind and observed and is held to that. Might be external object or might be internal, like the motion of the breath. But in the shamatha of Mahamudra, nothing serves as a support for the mind's observation. The mind is not aimed at anything, and one is not looking at anything. Rather, the mind is aware of its own factor of luminosity. And you know I like definitions, so I've got to go over to luminosity for a second. So rather, the mind is aware of its own luminosity. Where is this? Oh, that's right. So luminosity is a continuous knowing of the quality of your mind. So essentially, we're just resting on our mind. Okay. Next, I'm going to talk a little bit about non-distraction, because that was in the first line of this chapter of shamatha. Non-distraction is the body of meditation. Whatever arises is fresh, the nature of thought. So non-distraction is the body of meditation. When we say non-distraction, We mean that the function of meditation is to develop and maintain the capacity to keep our mind from not being overpowered by thought. So thought does exist, but we're not being overpowered by it. I know for myself, when I do shamatha, there's always, when I do ordinary shamatha, there's a point where I completely get distracted. I don't know if that happens to anyone else. For me, I like to plan. Suddenly a list will just suddenly show up somewhere in my brain, and I go right to it. Oh yeah, maybe I should order that. Yep. Then I have to just, you know, that 5, 10, 20 minutes, I'm already off. I'm already going back to my normal state. And that's fine. We don't beat ourselves up over it. But there's a little bit more exertion when we start doing this. But maybe I should say the exertion of no exertion, of just resting. So you can always experiment a tiny bit with this. And today I'm going to do a little guided meditation. I've got to start hurrying up here. I keep forgetting. Do any of you have any questions yet? I know it's kind of technical. Is it making sense? I hate when people ask that question. You better all say yes, no. Sorry. So let me just read a little bit more. Distraction is a problem we have. It's a condition in which the mind is beyond our control. And therefore, one thought produces another thought, which produces another thought. He stopped there. The problem with having thoughts arising beyond our control is that while we could have either good thoughts or negative thoughts, by far the majority are negative thoughts or bad thoughts even. So I don't know if any of you have ever had this where you're having a wonderful moment and then suddenly it just starts spinning a little bit out of control. Or maybe, you know, we're talking about quit on the cushion practice, but in our own life, shamatha can be practiced off the cushion. Because it trains you how to rest. It shows you where to go to relax the mind. But I'm being trained at another hospital right now. It's a little bit more intense around certain areas. And the other day, I just had to stop my mind. Like, don't worry about learning everything. Just relax. And I'm amazed sometimes how we really should use the tools of shamatha, of learning how to relax that mind, of becoming more friends with all of our spinning of our mind. And I know I'm kind of mixing up our shamatha and the shamatha, but they're very close. The shamatha we do here trains us for the next step, basically. So keep going with it. It's great. So going on, we're talking about distraction, how the mind spins out of them. Sometimes the thoughts that appear in our mind are extremely pleasant and cheer us up. At other times, the thoughts that run through our mind are extremely unpleasant and drive us crazy. If we look at them honestly, we'll see that due to karma and habits, the majority of the thoughts are by far unpleasant variety, and these thoughts make us extremely unhappy. Because of this, we can say that there is no point in following thoughts mindlessly. I think that's a real key thing here. It's not that we're not following thoughts. We follow thoughts all day long, but mindfulness has to become used a little bit more. It's more beneficial to take control of what is happening in our mind by simply applying mindfulness and alertness so that we can learn to relax our mind and pacify it. And then he talked about tranquility. And there's some really lovely benefits to shamatha, all shamatha. I'm going to make that's my statement, not his. But I've heard this before for regular shamatha. One, of course, is the word shamatha. Besides tranquility, the word shamatha in Sanskrit means peacefulness or abiding in peace. So we learn, our mind starts learning how to become more peaceful. And also affects our body. Our physical body becomes very affected by the practice. If you've studied at all anything about, I'm sure a lot of you have heard, you know, acupuncture, all the inner channels. We could use the gross outer talking about nervous system downward, but it's all been proven meditation really affects our nervous system, really calms all that down on a really deep level. So, I mean, Meditation is being taught all over the world now in hospitals, just in so many different units because of this healing ability. So this is something that you should really embrace. And it also helps with our immune system because it cuts out a lot of that unnecessary worrying that we seem to have a lot of, where we kind of go to. And as our mind becomes stable, it becomes much more lucid, and also our judgment improves. We have much clearer concept of what's really going on with others and with ourselves. So now I'm going to go through a few things for you, and we're going to talk about the ways to place, it's called placement of the mind. And then we're going to talk about physical technique, and I'm going to kind of walk you through that with the instruction. But let me go through the nine. I love these nine. I'll just read through it this way because it's kind of cool. So I think I've heard it called a few different things. We'll just call it the nine ways of placing the mind. Normally, we have one thought that is followed by another without a break, and we don't have much control over that. So the process of learning to transcend this endless discursivity of thought is traditionally divided into nine stages. I like that. The process of learning to transcend the endless discursivity of thought is traditionally divided into nine stages, which are called the nine ways of placing the mind. There's a great chart in here also. Let me just look at that for a second. This is very much Thongdrem Rinpoche. I didn't mention this, but if you go to a teaching with Kempo Karchi Rinpoche in the past, during the breaks and stuff, we would all just be talking or eating. But Thongdrem Rinpoche, his students study together and go over everything he had just said. They're great students. So that's why we have so many appendix here. This is just how they all are. Okay, here are the nine stages. The first one is resting the mind. In fact, I'm going to go back and read this. I think the language is too different. I love having, obviously one was done by one translator, one was the other. All right, so fundamentally, we are trying to let our mind settle in an uncontrived manner. Nevertheless, there has to be a certain progression, and here it is. First, it's called placement. Placement consists of letting our mind rest as much as possible. Then over time, the moments of rest will become longer, and it's called prolonged placement. For example, if you were able to remain in a state of non-distraction for a minute, that would be more prolonged. Next is called returning placement. This is something I think a lot of us here do. It's the point where, this is number three, where you learn to recognize that we become distracted, you notice that in your meditation. And this consists of recognizing that we're off thinking about something. And when this happens, we say, oh, thinking. Remember how we're trained to do that? And then you return to the technique. We should not regard these thoughts as important or a big deal in any way. The content of the thoughts are not particularly relevant to shamatha. We simply recognize the thought or feeling and then just return to the technique. So at this point, there's further obstacles that have to be overcome in our meditation. So then he goes on. So then number four is called taming. This refers to taming the mind, particularly in subduing this addiction to thought. Some people get really into thought, like thinking, thinking, thinking. And this is done, so the next few, they actually have special techniques. Let me read the other one. Taming the mind, one feels, you meditate, you feel joy, enthusiasm, and relaxation in one's meditation. And here it talks about, this is done, you increase your enthusiasm for the practice, and that helps you to be able to tame the mind better. It becomes more pliable, more workable. Then after that is pacification. This is number five. And here, instead of focusing on enthusiasm, we focus on our defects and the dangers of negative thoughts. So let me read this a little bit more. So pacification was six. The mind appears tame, but still wanders because we are still attached to wandering. Then complete pacification, whatever the distraction appears in the mind, one immediately applies the right antidote. The next one is one-pointed mind. One can place the mind almost completely, but it still needs some exertion. And lastly is resting in equanimity. The mind rests simply and naturally in its own nature. So these are just some progression and steps. And he goes through it very, very heavy detail. The next is the physical posture. And I thought it'd be nice to go over that because it's very important. There is a physical and a mental technique to use for this practice. And you've all heard this before, but I thought I would go over it. It's a little different. Now, admitted, we do use a lot of these practices. So there is an overlap because we do the 7 points of Airochana, or how we put our body. Okay, so here's the first technique, physical. The practice of shamatha is presented in the lineage prayer with non-distraction as the body of meditation, or essence of meditation. The practice of shamatha involves 2 types of techniques, and this is the physical. So this is very important, how we position the body when we meditate. Very important. If any of you have ever read the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, so much emphasis about if you sit correctly, your mind immediately, you have a satori experience because you're lining up all the inner energies, the winds, and everything. Everything's lining up deep inside of you. So it's the same in Mahamudra. Sitting is very important, how you sit. So if you tend to slump like I do, really work at it. And if you can, you sit in full lotus, which most of us can't do at a certain age. Lotus is only good because it keeps you from moving a lot. And the whole point in doing this practice is, after a while, you're going to be able to really practice. So you don't want to have a lot of... Have you ever noticed if you have a really achy knee, then your mind gets really agitated? They're all so connected. So, all right, here we go. So you said, ideally, we should be sitting on a cushion, but you could be standing or lying down. That's the first one, how you put your body. The second, our spine is straight. The third is your hands should be placed in a posture where they are resting evenly. Either it's in the Zen style at the navel, or the palms are down on your thighs. Each palm, each thigh. The next one is one some of you may never have heard. It's the fourth one. This one is regarding the elbows. They should be spread, meaning that our elbows should not be against our body. You guys do that already? I've never. So you're sitting like this. So what do? We had a straight spine. So he's starting in a very different... We're used to starting from the bottom up. This sort of starting differently. But your hands are on your thighs. And so instead of like this, there's more out here. You try that. It relieves the pressure on your shoulders so you can sit longer. And it also gives you more stability. It kind of makes you broader. I actually don't have that problem, but I think it's still pretty cool. So regarding the elbows, they should be spread, meaning that our elbows should not be against our body. This adds a little bit more rigor to the posture to wake us up. The fifth point, your chin should be drawn back a little bit towards your throat rather than projecting outward. This placement of the chin helps augment mindfulness and alertness. In some texts, it says that the sixth point is the tongue, which should be placed on the palate. So the tongue is just lifted up and not curled, and just tip of the teeth are behind, the tip of the tongue is behind the upper teeth, and your tongue just goes straight up. But there's a second one for number 6. Some say it's breathing. Breathing should be completely natural, which also lessens thoughts. The next one, in the 7th point, is our gaze. So in Mahamudra Shamatha, our gaze is slightly down or a little bit up in front of us. When we move on to Vipassana, it will be very different. So those are the 7 points of Airochana. So the reason for taking posture in meditation is that good posture produces a good state of mind. However, when we take this posture, it is necessary that the muscles of our body should be relaxed as possible, and we should be comfortable and not feel any tension. Also, in Machi Labdrin's text, this is in this book also, on the Chud practice, which is a practice of renunciation, her instructions are, relax all the limbs, all four limbs. Just relax them. So I've heard Rinpoche many times, he always said, not too tight and not too loose. Because if it's too loose, I'll just go right to sleep on you. So my mind has to stay a little tight to keep me awake, because I tend to really drift when I go when I sit. But my body has to be, you really have to make sure, and it takes a while for your muscles to build up, to sit like that. And just have patience. This all takes time. Yeah. All right. All right, I think the last, I'm going to go over really quickly two things. The next one is resting the mind. This is the most important thing of all, of course. So the basic approach to meditation is to turn the mental consciousness inward so that it looks at itself. So whatever, next in the book, the second line was, whatever arises is the fresh nature of thought. So this is what we are paying attention to, this very moment. So now we're talking about the focus. So there is a phrase in Mahamudra teachings, when you do meditation, you don't invite the past or beckon the future. You rest in the very moment. So that's where it's a little different than dealing with our other shamatha. We very purposefully work on the very moment, which is gone, right? The moment just went away. Every moment, you rest in this very moment. And of course, past and future are right around us all the time. So rather, we are to look at the present thought. This does not mean to examine the thought, or the content, just to rest in the cognition that is thinking by simply resting in the present moment of experience. I think that's the most important thing for what you do with the mind. He talks a lot about mindfulness, which is noticing if the mind has wandered off. That's what you're mindful about. What's the mind doing? Is it behaving? What is it all up to? But there are a couple more things I'm going to talk about here. We talked about the present moment. This was very interesting. I never heard this before. The Karmakagyu lineage holders have explained that we should engage in shamatha meditation so the mind will rest and remain stable. And this causes our body to be comfortable and free from hardship. So we should place the body in such a way that the essential points of meditation are maintained, but not too tightly, so that the body will be relaxed and stable. Then the mind should rest in the body, so mindfulness and awareness come about. So there's a lot about, this is in the Q&A, I wanted to read this to you. So someone said, Rinpoche said, because of the nature of the mind is a luminous clarity. Let me keep going. All right, here we go. When we talk about the mind resting within the body, we are talking mainly about sustaining mindfulness and attentiveness so that we know what we're doing and where we are. What it means is that we don't lose it completely. We don't just space out. We know that we're here. So, the next section is the third line. To the meditator who rests in naturalness, this line refers to the basic technique of remaining in the present moment. And I wanted to talk just for a second that the generation stage, in the deity practices that we do, are also a type of shamatha, are a type of Mahamudra Shamatha. And they say this all the time. And basically what, I don't know, I think a good analogy is somebody was telling me this the other day. He was telling me he can't meditate, but when he makes coffee in the morning, he grinds, he does something to the beans and has to really focus on how to grind it. He said he feels so happy and one-pointed, and because he's a worrier, and he's not worrying about anything. He's just in that very moment. And that's, so when we do the deity practices, and I know a lot of you do them, like Chenrezig or Medicine Buddha, the very beginning is called the generation stage, where we visualize the deity comes, and we visualize how the deity looks like, and also the surrounding. And that's also a type of shamatha. So I just want us to be aware of that, because I know we're running out of time right now. I'm sorry. So I think we'll just end it here. This is an amazing book. I'm sorry I went on and on. I'm really into it. Because it's amazing sometimes to have studied something for so many years and then read another book and go, oh, that's so simple. I mean, there's a lot of words, mindfulness and tranquility and all that. But the bottom line is, and I've said this so many times to other people, the first time I learned about Mahamudra was from Kempo Karchen Rinpoche. And he had a 10-day teaching in New York. This is 20-some years ago. And he said, when you leave here, whenever you drink a cup of tea or coffee, the moment when you start lifting it up and before it touches your lips, I want you to rest your mind. So I did this for a few months, and it had a deep effect on me. It's just so simple. That's Mahamudra. We're resting in Mahamudra all the time, and we don't know it. And Mahamudra is, I'm sure, why so many of our teachers have supercognition. Not that that's why we do this, but there's so many gifts that they have and so many abilities of teaching and understanding their students because of this. And I think it also leads us along a very virtuous path because I think it really, like it said, it gives us great judgment. So why don't we just take a moment, just offer the merit of your patience being here. And now let's read the prayer again. Since we have it right here, we'll just read it in English. And many people have said this is more than a prayer. You could do this just as one of your main practices. So, great Vajradhara, Taloba Naropa Marpa Milarepa, Lord of Dharma Gampopa, knower of the three times, omniscient Karmapa, lineage holders of the four great and eight lesser schools, Drikung, Taklung, Tsapa, glorious Drukpa, and others, you have mastered the profound path of Mahamudra, the Dakpo Kagyu, unrivaled protectors of sentient beings. I pray to you, Kagyu Lamas, grant your blessing that I may follow your tradition and example. As is taught, detachment is the foot of meditation. Attachment to food and wealth disappears. To the meditator who gives up the ties of this life, grant your blessing that attachment to ownership and honor cease. As is taught, devotion is the head of meditation. The Lama opens the door to the profound oral teachings. To the meditator who always turns to them, grant your blessing that uncontrived devotion be born within. As is taught, unwavering attention to the body of is the body of meditation. Whatever arises is the fresh nature of thought. To the meditator who rests therein naturalness, grant your blessing that meditation be free from intellectualization. As is taught, the essence of thoughts is Dharmakaya. They are nothing whatsoever, and yet they arise. To the meditator who reflects upon the unobstructed play of the mind, grant your blessing that the inseparability of samsara and nirvana be realized. Through all my births, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama and so enjoy the glory of the Dharma. May I completely accomplish the qualities of the path and stages and quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Yeehaw! Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.